Another complication is that the conception of philosophy against which Quine tends to contrast his own argument is not one to which Wittgenstein would want to subscribe. Quine's primary target is the traditional idea of a first philosophy, which he finds in the writings of Descartes and onward, all the way up to Carnap. "My position," he says, quote, "is a naturalistic one. I see philosophy not as an a priori propedeutic or groundwork for science, but as continuous science." End of quote. This shows that the view of philosophy from which Quine first and foremost wants to distance himself is a view that Wittgenstein would also want to reject. Wittgenstein's way of distinguishing philosophy from science does not involve any claim to the effect that philosophy can, in some non-empirical a priori fashion, provide a foundation for empirical research. This is clearly so with respect to the later Wittgenstein, and arguably it is equally true of the author of the Tractatus. If we look at Quine from Wittgenstein's point of view, he seems to have a much too limited conception of the alternatives available for thinking about the relation between philosophy and science. Quine tends to argue as if either you accept that philosophy is continuous with science, or you will have to subscribe to some variety of the traditional idea of a first philosophy. Whereas what Wittgenstein wants to achieve is something different from both these alternatives. According to him, the task of philosophy is neither to give us new factual knowledge, nor to constitute the pillar upon which the special sciences must rest, but to engage in purely clarificatory investigations aimed at dissolving conceptual confusions. From Quine's point of view, the idea that there is such a third, clearly distinguishable alternative is mistaken. Quine seems to think that, in the end, the very idea of a sharp distinction between empirical and conceptual investigations must presuppose some version of the idea of a first philosophy. Even if Wittgenstein tries to steer clear of this traditional conception, Quine would probably say that his ideas about philosophy's distinctive character reveals that he is still held captive by a traditional and misconceived picture of the relation between philosophy and science. So I cannot, within the limited space of this paper, give a full account of the differences between Quine's and Wittgenstein's conceptions of philosophy. My aim here is much more restricted. I will focus on one aspect of the difference between Quine's and Wittgenstein's conceptions, an aspect which I take to be of central importance. More precisely, I will look at one of the few places in Quine's writings where he relates his own view of philosophy to what he takes to be Wittgenstein's conception, namely sections 53 and 54 of Word and Object. Interestingly enough, Quine here claims that there is a similarity between his own views and Wittgenstein's. Comparing Quine's discussion with an example from Wittgenstein, I will argue that this alleged similarity is an illusion. Indeed, I hope my comparison will give a clearer sense of how different the philosophical outlooks of these two thinkers really are. So, section 2, Quine on explication as a way of dissolving philosophical problems. Sections 53 and 54 of Word and Object constitute Quine's most sustained discussion of explication as a philosophical method. And Quine's paradigm example is the set theoretical explications of the notion of ordered pair, offered by mathematicians such as Wiener and Kuratowski. So, Quine says, ordered pair might seem indispensable in science, but at the same time, they may seem troublesome. Due to the fact that they don't obey the principle of extensionality, so the ordered pair... the ordered pair XY is not identical with the ordered pair YX. And this has, in fact, troubled people, especially during the 19th century. Many mathematicians and logicians asked themselves, you know, what is it that makes an ordered pair ordered? And some thought that this required some sort of philosophical explanation philosophical account. Quine quotes Peirce as someone who tries to give a kind of semiotic explanation of what makes an ordered pair ordered, in contrast to sets, which aren't ordered in that sense. Now, these troubles, Quine says, should be dissolved, and the way to dissolve them is to show that they proceed from scientifically superfluous usages. And here's how the solution is supposed to work. First, we should note that the scientifically relevant employments of the notion of ordered pair are captured by a single, very simple postulate, which you have on your handout, postulate number one. So if the ordered pair XY is identical with the ordered pair ZW, then X is identical to Z and Y is identical to W. So this postulate encapsulates the scientific work done by the notion of ordered pair. Now, Wiener's achievement, Quine argues, was to show that the same work can be done by a set theoretical extensional substitute. So Wiener suggested that we explicate, we identify the ordered pair XY with a certain set, namely the following set. This is also on your handout, number two. So Wiener identified the ordered pair XY with the set of X and the set of Y and the empty set. Now, since identical sets have the same members, it follows that if this set and the set following set if these two sets are identical, then X is identical to Z and Y is identical to W. So these two sets can play exactly the same role as the ordered pairs here. So these two, Wiener's explication takes care of this postulate, and thereby it takes care of all the scientific relevant work performed by the notion of ordered pair. And according to Quine, the possibility of such an extensional construal shows that any worry we might have about the non-extensional character of ordered pairs can simply be left aside as scientifically immaterial. Wiener dissolves our philosophical qualms by showing that, as scientists, we don't have to care about them. Now, Wiener is not offering a conceptual analysis in any traditional sense of the word, for he makes no synonymy claims. The claim is not that this expression is synonymous with this expression. The claim is just that this expression can replace this expression in all scientifically relevant contexts. And according to Quine, I mean, the point is just that nothing of scientific importance is lost if we reinterpret talk about ordered pairs as talk about sets. On the contrary, such reinterpretation involves scientific gains. We are able to handle observational data in a more economical manner, since the old notion of ordered pair is replaced by set theoretical notions that are already in use elsewhere. And one aspect of this benefit is that Wiener's explication involves the elimination of what Quine calls ontological commitments. According to Quine, the explication takes us from a theory which postulates ordered pairs in addition to sets to a theory which identifies ordered pairs with sets. Our earlier worries about the non-extensional character of ordered pairs were connected with the view that ordered pairs have something which distinguishes them from sets, a perplexing non-extensional character which seemed to require philosophical explanation. Wiener's explication should make us realize that this distinctive property is best seen as an illusion, according to Ponty. Now, Quine argues that a similar strategy of disillusion applies to other, philosophically more significant, perplexities. Consider the many traditional worries associated with a dualist conception of mental states and events as being distinct from physiological states and events. According to Quine, the scientific purpose of positing such distinct mental states and events can only be to develop a systematic theory which explains and predicts the behavior of human organisms. Just like the positing of atoms and molecules helps us predict and explain the behavior of physical objects. But, Quine remarks, and this is quotation 3 on your handout, if a certain organization of theory is achieved by thus positing distinctive mental states and events behind physical behavior, surely as much organization could be achieved by positing merely certain correlative physiological states and events instead. The bodily states exist anyway, why add the others? And the point here is exactly analogous to the one made about ordered pairs. Quine isolates what he takes to be the scientific work done by the notion of mental states and events. He then points out that that work may just as well be done by physiological substitutes. Without any scientific loss, we can reinterpret talk of distinct mental entities as talk about physiological entities or states of the body, and thereby get rid of the traditional worries about the mental. For these worries presuppose that mental states and events are non-physical. This supposition, Quine argues, is a scientifically superfluous idea which can simply be discarded. Just as when ordered pairs get explicated in set theoretical terms, Quine thinks the physiological explication of the mental involves the elimination of ontological commitments. Supposedly, it takes us from a dualist theory, which postulates mental states and events in addition to physiological states and events, to a theory according to which mental states and events are nothing but physiological states and events. What underlies our perplexities was the dualist idea that mental states and events are somehow mysteriously non-physical. And the perplexities, says Quine, disappear once we realize that making such an ontological distinction between the mental and the physical constitutes a scientifically needless way of speaking. Section 3, Wittgenstein on the connectives. Now, Quine explicitly relates his discussion of explication to Wittgenstein's claim that philosophical problems should be dissolved rather than solved. And I'm quoting now from passage number 4 on your handout. This doctrine, Wittgenstein's doctrine that philosophical problems should be dissolved rather than solved, this doctrine, says Quine, has its limitations, but it aptly fits explication. For when explication banishes a problem, it does so by showing it to be, in an important sense, unreal, namely in the sense of proceeding only from needless usages. End of quote. Quine then goes on to argue that most followers of Wittgenstein miss this point. Instead of appreciating the kinship between Wittgenstein's approach and explication, they complain that explications are unfaithful to ordinary language use. This complaint, Quine says, is completely misguided. In fact, he argues, it is precisely the unfaithfulness to ordinary language which makes explication useful for the dissolution of philosophical problems. Quote, "For it is precisely by showing how to circumvent the problematic parts of ordinary usage that we show the problems to be purely verbal." End of quote. Now, I think Quine is quite wrong in suggesting that Wittgenstein's approach to philosophical problems is similar to explication. But this is not to say that Wittgenstein is an ordinary language philosopher in Quine's caricatured sense. Quine is quite right that Wittgenstein does not think that deviating from established language use is in itself a philosophical sin. The real difference between Wittgenstein and Quine is more intricate, but nonetheless deep and fundamental. Quine's talk of banishing and circumventing philosophical problems already provides a clue to the nature of this difference. For banishing or circumventing a problem is different from dissolving it. While dissolution suggests disintegration under the pressure exerted by demands for clarification, circumvention and banishment suggest not disintegration but dismissal. And dismissing problems is precisely what Quine thinks explication allows us to do. The point of explication is not to make us realize that we have failed to give sense to the words we use to express the problems, but to make it clear that the ontological commitments against the background of which the problems appear important are superfluous. What explication is supposed to show is that, for scientific purposes, usages which involve these ontological commitments can safely be left aside. According to Quine, being worried about, say, the possibility of causal interaction between a non-physical mind and a physical body is like being worried about how Santa Claus is able to deliver Christmas presents to all children in just one night, or about how witches can fly. His objection is not that such worries are nonsensical, but that they are scientifically futile. To shed more light on how Wittgenstein's and Quine's conceptions differ, I will discuss an example from Wittgenstein's early writings. One reason why I use this example is that on the surface, it may look rather similar to Quinean explication. But in fact, the difference is significant, and I think pinpointing this difference sheds much light on Wittgenstein's way of approaching philosophical worries. Using an example from the early writings in this sort of way means presupposing that there is a fundamental continuity between Wittgenstein's early and later writings as far as his conception of philosophy is concerned. This assumption needs to be argued for, but space does not allow me to do so here. But toward the end of the paper, I will briefly discuss an example from the later writings, and I hope that that discussion will clarify the continuity in question. Okay, so already in 1913, Wittgenstein expresses dissatisfaction with existing logical notations, and in particular with the sentential connectives of Principia Mathematica. According to Wittgenstein, constructions like these, not P, but P or Q, wrongly suggest that negation and disjunction make some sort of genuine contribution to the content of sentences. The connectives here look misleadingly similar to names or predicates. In fact, Wittgenstein questions the very idea clearly suggested by the Russell-Whitehead notation that the role of the connectives is to form complex propositions by, as it were, gluing together elementary propositions. According to Wittgenstein, it might even be misleading to say that the simpler propositions on the basis of which complex propositions are generated occur in the complex propositions. In 1914, he says, quote, "A proposition cannot have to another the internal relation which a name has to the proposition of which it is a constituent, and which ought to be meant by saying that it occurs in it." This is quotation 5 on your hand. As Peter Sullivan remarks, the word name in this passage should be construed broadly to mean any expression replaceable by a variable to yield a propositional function. Thus, Wittgenstein's point is that there are no propositional functions that take propositions as arguments. Surely, the truth value of, say, the proposition expressed by not P, is a function of the truth value of the proposition expressed by sign P. But the proposition expressed by this sign is not itself a function of the proposition expressed by P. A proper understanding of the connectives requires that we think of the relations between propositions, not in functional, but in operational terms. Now, this is intimately connected with Wittgenstein's introduction of the so-called TF notation in the Tractatus. This notation is meant to clarify the nature of the logical interconnectedness of propositions. In this notation, a proposition is given by its truth table, or, in a more condensed version of the notation, by a schema where the last column of the truth table is given within parentheses before the elementary propositions are listed. A couple of examples. So the proposition P and Q in a sort of standard logical notation is formulated like this. In the truth table notation, the same proposition is formulated like this. So this is a Tractarian truth table. In the condensed version of this notation, you take this last column here and write it like this. Can you read that? Okay. So you take this last column, write it within parentheses before a parenthesis in which you write P and Q. P and Q. One might also note that, for example, a simple proposition P like this can also be formulated in the truth table notation, then it would look like this. Like this. And in the condensed version of the notation, this will be the formulation corresponds to this in the standard notation. Now, we have to keep firmly in mind here that a truth table for Wittgenstein is not a metalinguistic device used to calculate the logical properties of sentences. It is simply a clear, more perspicuous re-articulation of a proposition. Truth tables simply re-articulate propositions in a way which makes their logical interrelations more perspicuous. So a truth table is itself a propositional sign at the same level as the less clear sign which it is meant to replace. And this comes out if we notice a kind of what we might experience as an oddity about Tractarian truth tables, namely that there is no sign here. This is an empty. You write nothing here if you write a Tractarian truth table. In elementary courses in logic, when we learn to use truth tables to calculate the logical properties of sentences, at least this is how I learned. For example, if we take the following proposition. Not if P, then not Q. Okay, how do we use a truth table in elementary logic courses to calculate the logical properties of this sentence? Well, we write a truth table something like this. So here we write P, here we write Q, and here we write that proposition. And then we do something like this. We put T here. And then we first looked at this negation sign, and we turned the T and the F. And then we think about the implication sign here, and that the implication sign here, then we should take these two into consideration. It would be false here, it would be true otherwise. And then we simply apply the negation, think of the negation in relation to what we achieved here, so we get T, F, F, F. So that's how we use the truth table as a sort of device for calculating. But that is not how Wittgenstein sees it in the Tractatus. He sees it simply as a rearticulation, so he doesn't write anything here. Two propositional signs get rearticulated in precisely the same way, namely in this way, in the Tractatus. So these are the equivalence between these two propositional signs is shown by the fact that they get rearticulated in exactly the same way in the truth table notation, so, or in this more condensed variety of the notation. So what's the point now? What's the point about the connectives? Well, let us think about this more condensed variety of notations. With respect to that notation, Wittgenstein's point becomes clear. And Sullivan uses the following example to illustrate Wittgenstein's point. So as I just said, in Wittgenstein's notation, these two signs are both rendered as this truth table, or as this sign. Let me write this more. So this is how both these propositional signs gets translated in Wittgenstein's notation. Now, in order to negate this proposition, we don't add anything to it. Okay? We don't add a negation sign. Rather, we turn the proposition into a new one by replacing all T's with F's and all F's with T's. So starting from this sign here, we transform it. To negate it means to transform it into this sign. Replace the T by an F and these two F's by T's, and that according to this pattern. This is what it means to negate the proposition. And this makes it clear that negating a proposition is not a matter of adding anything to it, but of using it as a base from which a new proposition is generated according to a determinate pattern of transformation. And the same is true of conjunction, disjunction, and so on. And quotation 6 on your handout, Wittgenstein says, an operation is the expression of a relation between the structure of its results and of its basis. The operation is what has to be done to the one proposition in order to make the other out of it. And this does away with any temptation to think that there is something essentially negative about propositions obtained by procedures of negation. Negation, Sullivan concludes, quote, is characteristic only of the relation between two propositions, never of any proposition itself. Okay. So the point of Wittgenstein's TF notation is to make it less tempting to say that the elementary propositions on the basis of which a non-elementary proposition is generated occur in the non-elementary proposition. The signs P and Q are parts of the sign, of this sign. And this makes us inclined to think that the propositions they express are part of the conjunction in a similar sort of way as A and B are parts of A or B. So the standard notation makes this proposition and this proposition look too similar according to Wittgenstein. By contrast, it is clear that this sign, which corresponds to P here, is not in that sense part of this sign, for example. In this sentence, there is no occurrence of this sentence such that replacing this by a variable would yield a propositional function. And this is one of the beauties of Wittgenstein's notation. On the one hand, it makes transparent how the truth value of this proposition depends functionally on the truth value of a proposition like this. On the other hand, the notation makes it clear that the way in which the proposition itself is constructed from the elementary propositions is not to be understood in functional terms. Okay, I hope what I've said makes clear the intimate connection between Wittgenstein's introduction of the TF notation and what, in the Tractatus, he calls his fundamental idea, that the logical constants are not representatives, that there can be no representatives of the logic of facts. And that is number 8 on your handout, paragraph 403.12 of the Tractatus. And in paragraph 5.4, right after having discussed operations on propositions, Wittgenstein frankly concludes that, quote, there are no logical objects or logical constants in Frege's and Russell's sense. And that's number 9 on your hand. Now I want to discuss these two last passages, number 8 and number 9. And if I read them correctly, they express the same point. What might be confusing is that in the first paragraph, number 403.12, Wittgenstein uses the term logical constants to refer to certain signs, whereas in paragraph 5.4 he seems to be using the same term to talk about what Russell and Frege take such signs to represent. In fact, the difference in expression between these two paragraphs are directly relevant to the main topic of my paper. So taken ad notam, paragraph 5.4 seems to say that the signs for the connectives, as standardly used in logic books, purport to represent but fail to do so because the entities which they are meant to stand for do not exist. That's sort of natural reading of paragraph 5.4. And this suggests a reading according to which Wittgenstein's introduction of the TF notation is akin to Quinean explication. According to this sort of reading, Wittgenstein thinks that replacing the standard notation of the principia with the TF notation means abandoning a framework according to which there are such entities as negation, disjunction, and so forth, in favor of a framework which is not committed to the existence of such entities. Allegedly, the point of the TF notation would be to show how logic can be done without this commitment, and thereby make it clear that the commitment is superfluous. If this is right, Wittgenstein's idea is that abandoning this commitment allows us to banish or circumvent many seemingly deep philosophical worries, such as what is the subject matter of logic and what justifies logical inference. The way Wittgenstein expresses himself in paragraph 403.12, however, suggests a quite different sort of interpretation. According to this second kind of reading, Wittgenstein's aim is not to make it clear that those signs, as standardly used in logic books, do not purport to... According to this second kind of reading, Wittgenstein's aim is to make it clear that those signs, as standardly used in logic books, do not purport to represent, even if their surface appearance may entice us to think so. Thus, the point of the TF notation, according to this second sort of reading, is not to dispose of ontological commitments inherent in the standard logical notation, but to make it clear that there are no such commitments to begin with. According to this reading, Wittgenstein's criticism of the Principia notation is not that it purports to talk about entities that need not be taken to exist, for it doesn't. Rather, Wittgenstein's diagnosis is that the notation's surface appearance makes it overwhelmingly tempting to think that the function of those signs is analogous to the function of signs which do play the role of representatives. According to Wittgenstein, there is nothing wrong as such with using the Principia notation. The use itself is perfectly all right. Rather, his point is that the way the notation looks on paper makes us prone to misconstrue its actual employment. And the supposed advantage of the TF notation is that it does not foster such misunderstanding. Now, this second reading seems much closer to Wittgenstein's actual intentions. What Wittgenstein offers is a diagnosis to the effect that philosophical confusion arises because of a conflict between the way in which we are accustomed to use the standard notation, standard Principia notation, and the pictures or analogies prompted by the notation's surface appearance. Consider a very simple example. When we do classical propositional logic in the standard notation, we negate P by adding a negation sign, not P. Okay. Clearly, one wants to say P and not P do not say the same thing. After all, they contradict each other. Since the only difference we're able to perceive between these two sentences is that one of them involves a negation sign, it seems natural to conclude that this negation sign makes a substantial contribution to the content of the sentence in which it occurs. So we're tempted to think that not P says something else than P because the negation sign has a meaning of its own, which is somehow added to the meaning of P. And then we're not far from thinking that not P says something about the state of affairs described by P, namely that that state of affairs is not the case. In other words, we reason as if the proposition created by adding a negation sign to P describes, as it were, an essentially negative fact. And once we have reached this point in our reasoning, it will be difficult to avoid the idea that the negation sign must represent some sort of real entity. We run into difficulties, however, as soon as we consider the fact that negation cancels itself when doubled. Okay. So not P says the same thing as P. If the negation sign leaves a substantial contribution to the content of the sentences in which it occurs, then why doesn't it do so in its doubled form? How can the result which we get by adding another negation sign be equivalent to a sentence which contains no negation sign at all? If Wittgenstein is read in the way I suggest that we read him, he would say that the root of this quandary is that we waver unwittingly between construing the use of the negation sign in two incompatible ways. On the one hand, our notation tempts us to think that the function of the negation sign must be analogous to the function of names or predicates. On the other hand, we remember somewhat inchoately that our customary use of the negation sign is such that not P is equivalent to P. That's how we use the negation sign. We think we have to give an account which does justice to both these construals, but at the same time we vaguely feel that this is impossible. Hence a sense of paradox or contradiction. The nature of negation seems elusive or mysterious. Since an account which does justice to both construals seems required and yet unachievable. Now, Wittgenstein's TF notation helps us dissolve this worry by showing that the idea that the negation sign leaves some sort of substantial contribution to the content of the sentences in which it occurs is an illusion created by the orthographic features of the Principia notation. Our problem is not circumvented or banished. Rather, it completely disintegrates once we realize that the paradox depended on our failure to see that we were hovering between two incompatible viewpoints. The puzzle about double negation may seem like a too simple example of a philosophical worry, but I would argue that Wittgenstein offers a similar diagnosis of more serious difficulties, which his TF notation is also meant to help us dissolve. So when he says that the propositions of logic have no subject matter, or that laws of inference, which are supposed to justify inferences, have no sense and would be superfluous, he is not saying that commitments to a logical subject matter and to laws that justify inferences are scientifically unnecessary. Rather, his point is that these ideas are due to misleading pictures of what is actually and already involved in our daily activity of making logical inferences. Pictures which are created by the surface structure of the notation we happen to be using, and which lead not to meaningful but futile questions, but to seemingly irresolvable antinomies. I cannot here discuss Wittgenstein's treatment of these more serious quandaries. Let me finish instead by briefly mentioning an example from Wittgenstein's later writings, which may serve to further clarify the difference between his and Quine's conceptions, or what it means to solve philosophical problems. What I have in mind is Wittgenstein's treatment of sensations and philosophical investigations. He says, quote, "If we construe the grammar of the expression of sensation on the model of object and designation, the object drops out of consideration as irrelevant." It would be a gross misunderstanding to read this passage as saying that since the grammar of the expression of sensation is to be construed of the model of object and designation, it is superfluous to postulate the existence of sensations. Rather, Wittgenstein questions the very idea that the role of an expression of sensation is to be construed according to such a model. According to Wittgenstein, the temptation to think that expressions of sensations function in a similar sort of way as, say, names of ordinary physical objects is due to the surface similarity between sentences such as "I have a toothache" and "I have a beetle in my box." Taken seriously, this analogy leads to perplexities such as solipsism, and the way to dissolve those perplexities is to remind oneself of the difference in use between ordinary names and expressions of sensation. The contrast with Quine is clear. As we have seen, Quine thinks the philosophical problems about sensations should be circumvented by giving a physicalistic reinterpretation of our sensation terms. If Wittgenstein is right, this leaves the fundamental illusion intact, namely that the role of sensation terms is to designate objects. Unless this illusion is uprooted, Wittgenstein thinks the philosophical problems have not been adequately treated but swept under the rug. Wittgenstein says, "A philosophical problem has the form I don't know my way about." For him, it is a characteristic of philosophical worries that they have a strong taste of contradiction, paradox, irresolvable dilemma. According to Wittgenstein's diagnosis, the source of such a problem is a conflict of which the worried person is not clearly aware, between customary usage and the pictures and analogies which the surface appearance of words produces in the person's mind. Given this sort of diagnosis, it will be important to provide the worried person with a perspicuous overview of established usage, not because deviation from such established usage is wrong per se, it isn't, of course, but because such an overview will help him become aware of the inconsistent hovering from which his perplexity arises. Giving such an overview will be a matter of reminding the person of something he, in a sense, already knows, qua language user. And providing such reminders is what Wittgenstein is up to when he offers a new notation, which does justice to how the relevant parts of language functions in practice. For Quine, philosophical worries are similar to scientific problems. Indeed, he thinks many philosophical problems are good scientific problems. But there are also philosophical problems which, Quine argues, are better left aside, and he thinks explication is the way in which they ought to be dismissed. What explication shows is not that such a problem is incoherent or nonsensical, but that it involves usages and ontological commitments which are not needed for scientific theory construction. Quine's conception of what it means to dissolve philosophical problems is thus congenial to his view of philosophy as continuous with science, for his whole approach is based on the idea that it is science which provides the yardstick determining whether or not a problem is worth caring about. By contrast, Wittgenstein thinks using science as a measure of relevance only makes it the more difficult to identify the real source of our philosophical worries. Okay, thank you.